On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For any opposition looking for a target, it's not hard to see the GOP these days as a big, fat softball ready to be hit out of the park. Osama's uncaptured, the Iraq War's a mess, Afghanistan's backsliding, Katrina incompetence still rankles, average American incomes going nowhere, the economy's housing life raft is losing air. So what do the Democrats have to say and to offer? This hour, we'll ask them. Congressman Rahm Emanuel is the Dems' point man for taking back the House. Bruce Reed is president of the Democratic Leadership Council. They know Democrats have swung and missed before, but they've got a plan. Up next on Point, with big elections coming, Democrats step to the plate. We look first today at yesterday's primary elections around the country and the road to November with John Zogby, president and CEO of Zogby International, a public opinion research and consulting company. He joins us from Utica, New York. John, you've looked out across the country, 9 states and the District of Columbia with primaries. What do you see?
Well, yesterday was just an eclectic mess. On one hand, you had the biggest race, Lincoln Chafee, moderate Republican, the beneficiary of a ton of RNC money, really winning handily, after all. And I think that was indigenous to Rhode Island more than anything else, although it certainly showed that the RNC does have some juice when it needs it. On the other hand, states like Arizona, where you had really a mixed bag of an ultra-conservative winning in one House district and a more mainstream Republican winning in another district, no real message that emerged except that the voters might be in a feisty mood this year.
So put yourself in the Republican and then the Democratic cockpits for a moment here, parsing these tea leaves the morning after the primaries. Who gets the better signal?
I think it's a draw, and I'm not sure that that's what your listeners want to hear, but, you know, there is always the potential for a Democratic landslide because the Republicans do, in fact, go into this election cycle severely wounded. But we're seeing some evidence of some Republicans that were down on the ropes. Rick Santorum, for example, Mike DeWine, another, Pennsylvania and Ohio, respectively, who were in deep, deep trouble, who are closing the gap in the U.S. Senate. On the other hand, you see George Allen in Virginia, who was supposed to coast to a relatively easy victory, fighting for his political life. And then, Tom, if I'm allowed a third hand, we'll go right up into Michigan, where the economy is terrible. Debbie Stabenow, the incumbent Democrat, very popular through most of her 5 and a half years in office, is on the ropes right now.
So the Republican National Committee announcing today it will spend its entire bank account, $60 million, maybe more, to try and retain control of Congress in the November elections. Look at those two houses of Congress for us for a second, John. Dems need 15 seats, I think, to take the House, 6 seats to take the Senate. Now Lincoln Chafee still in a fairly safe column, though he's got a real race in Rhode Island for the Republicans. How do each of those challenges look, House and Senate, this morning?
Well, it looks as if Democrats pick up a net gain of seats in the Senate. Whether they get the 6 that they need is going to be tough. They may be helped by the fact that a race like Virginia, for example, that wasn't supposed to be on the list, is on the list. Democrats could potentially win it. The House of Representatives looks again like the Democrats do pick up seats, but 16 seats in order to win control is an awful lot of seats. There are races today that are competitive. I'm sitting in one right now, the 24th Congressional District here in New York, Sherwood Bowler, moderate Republican, an open seat. And as we speak, that's a race that's too close to call, but maybe give the edge to the Democrats.
Look beyond the voting booth to polls for just a second, John. I look at a CNN poll here recently saying 84% of Americans wish Congress had done more. Only 12% say they're satisfied with Congress. Of course, it's been a Republican Congress. Why isn't that a cakewalk for Democrats?
Because it could very well turn into an anti-incumbent mood, and that's one of the possible scenarios that can play out. I'm going to be anxious to hear what Bruce Reed and Rahm Emanuel have to say. But I think where we stand right now, Republicans very wounded, Democrats offering no compelling message or plan or alternative, especially on the issue that I call the elephant in the living room, and that is, of course, the war in Iraq. And with that said, then, this race, this national campaign still has not yet taken shape.
Still wide open. John Zogby, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
John Zogby, President and CEO of Zogby International. Joining me now from Washington are Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Reed, co-authors of the new book, The Plan, Big Ideas for America. Rahm Emanuel is a Democratic congressman from Illinois' 5th District. He's also chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee from 93 to 98. He served under President Bill Clinton, first as assistant to the president for political affairs, then as senior advisor for policy and strategy. He is point man for the Democrats' push to take back the House in November's midterm elections. Rahm Emanuel, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
We're great and glad to have you both. Also with us from Washington, Bruce Reed, president of the Democratic Leadership Council, editor-in-chief of Blueprint, the DLC's bimonthly journal. He also served in the Clinton White House for 8 years as chief domestic policy advisor. Bruce Reed, great to have you with us as well.
Thanks, Tom.
Let me get the take of you two first. Just on yesterday's primaries, you heard John Zogby say right there, it's still wide open. Wounded Republicans, but no compelling message from the Democrats. How do you interpret yesterday's results, Rahm Emanuel?
Well, first of all, I mean, you take a look at Arizona. The Republican, my counterpart, Tom Reynolds, went in the Republican primary in the Colby open Republican seat, and they lost. In fact, State Senator Graff won that Republican primary, and the incumbent Republican congressman says, I will never endorse him. And so you have a divided Republican Party, which is what you're seeing also all over the country. Even though Chafee, Senator Chafee won in Rhode Island, he was, had a serious primary on his hands. And so the Republican Party is divided between its wings of the party, and in fact, Democrats are united. And what I would slightly disagree with Jim about is, in fact, not only are Democrats united in taking the country in a new direction, there is no doubt, as there were 6 months ago, whether we're going to win seats or whether Republicans are going to win seats. Everybody now concludes we're going to win seats. The only question open, how many we're going to win. And if you look at the stack of data on the direct people's sense about the country, about the war, the economy, about which party they want to take the country, the financial parity in the parties, I would never want to change places with Republicans today. And I know a lot of Republicans would rather have our hand going into this election rather than the hand they got dealt.
Of course, Bruce Reed, the whole question is not just who will win seats, but will the Democrats win enough to take a majority? You've got the House point man sitting right next to you there, but looking off the primaries, what's your assessment? How strong are the Democrats' prospects in the House, in the Senate? How are you reading it?
Well, it's a very tough year for incumbents. As you said at the top of the hour, the country's a mess. That's a great opportunity for Democrats to argue for a new direction, and I think we'll make gains across the board, including in a lot of governorships around the country. Whether we end up with majorities in both houses depends on the next couple of months. We saw yesterday there's tremendous enthusiasm on the Democratic side and a lot of division and grumbling on the Republican side.
Rahm Emanuel, let's get you on the record here. You said it's just a question of how many seats the Democrats will win, but do you or do you not think the Democrats will take majorities in the House, in the Senate? Where do you stand today?
No, well, Tom, my job as chair of the DCCC is to affect races, not predict them. And I, even though we're 1 week past Labor Day, I think you're not gonna know that answer even on October 10th, and I wouldn't want to get in a position of making a prediction. But let me go back to one point.
Well, may I just ask you why not? I mean, you're the head of the House effort. If there's such a head of steam here, you must be reading the tea leaves very closely.
Well, in your business like in my business, 58 days is a long time.
Yes, it
and
is.
Any person that makes predictions is not telling you the truth, because you can't make a prediction with 58 days to go in politics. A lot can happen in that time. But I know right now we're going to make gains. We're going to make significant gains. Will it be enough? My sense is a jump ball today. But two other points I want to make.
Mm.
In that Arizona Republican seat I told you,
yes,
that has been a Republican seat, 54,000 Democrats showed up on Election Day primary and 55,000 Republicans, meaning that district now is parity in a sense between the two parties. In Wisconsin, where you have another open seat held by a Republican, 31,000 Democrats showed up, 27,000 Republicans showed up for their primary, meaning there were more Democrats excited at turning out. So you're having increasing turnout among Democrats in just two open seats where you had competitive primaries on both sides in both districts, saying that there's more energy in our party and more interest time and again for the last year on that poll. There is a referendum. If you look at history, 1974 Watergate election, big national midterm election. 1982, Reagan's recession, big midterm nationalized election. 86, Social Security, Democrats take back the Senate. 94, we lost the House and the Senate when we were in the White House because of our inability to deliver on health care. And in 98, we made gains in the House, which is the first time in 100 years of party in power. Every time a midterm election has been nationalized on the incumbent party's stewardship, the party out of power has made huge, significant gains. And that is what is shaping up this year. The one difference is you have a gerrymandered map that is much different than what past precedent has occurred. But I'd rather be us going into this election. It's still 58 days to go. There's a lot to happen. But I know we're going to make significant gains in this process. Anybody that tells you they can predict the outcome of November isn't in the business of politics.
Rahm Emanuel, Bruce Reed, you've got the plan. Point by point, your kind of big ideas, as you put them, for the country's future. But you say it's not a contract with America like the one Newt Gingrich rode with such success to a Republican majority in 1994. Rahm Emanuel, why not?
Well, Bruce and I... Bruce mainly helped write Putting People First, and I helped with Bruce implementing that agenda. That was the book President Clinton ran on in 92 about his ideas. And if you're looking for kind of a precedent, what is the plan, the shoulders it's built on, the model was Putting People First, not the contract with America, because that was a successful period of time where we both reduced the deficit, created a surplus, reduced crime, reduced the welfare rolls, helped raise incomes across all economic groups, and kept America's economic competitiveness around the world at the lead. And we think that it is that type of agenda and that strategy of putting your fiscal house in order and investing in the education, healthcare, energy, and technological independence of America is the right strategy. And we lay out a strategy basically with this premise, Tom, that the global economy has created huge transformations in our economy and society. And the private sector, some successful, some not successful, are making adaptations for that. Intel, Apple Computer, GM, Ford, United Airlines.
They're adapting.
They're adapting, and some successfully, some not successfully.
Mm-hmm.
But on the public policy side, our higher education programs and investment strategy, our budget, our tax policy, our healthcare policy, we are not making any of the transformations on that side of the ledger in the public policy area to make sure that the 21st century remains the American century like the 20th century. And so as you see this massive transformation and pressures of the global economy, what it's doing to retirement plans, what it's doing to health care benefits and co-payments and premiums, what our education policies are or not doing, and that we have to change our policies in those areas, critical areas, energy and technology also, and make sure that in those areas that that strategy is and those policies are updated. And the second point is, and something we learned in a philosophy with President Clinton and believe strongly with, is that citizenship is not an entitlement program. It begins with responsibility. At every point in American history, when we've started with the notion of responsibility, that if you take responsibility for your life and do what's right, that then the doors of opportunity will open. But that has been a successful strategy for America in conquering and dealing with every one of its challenges, both here at home and abroad. And so it's a two-part strategy. One, adopting this policy of responsibility as a national policy in the sense of a value system, and two, upgrading our public policy positions in areas of education, etc., to match the challenges of this global economy and the dynamics of this global economy, because you can see it happening in the private sector. But for the last 6 years in the public sector, we've been frozen in place, and therefore America's competitive economic advantage is being deteriorated.
We're going to look at where you all would send the country. But Bruce Reed, let me put the same question to you. If you guys have such a good plan, if the Democrats are now united and have such a big opportunity, why isn't this a contract with America? I mean, Newt Gingrich rode that to an awful lot of success. Republicans took the Congress. Is the fact that you're still inviting people to sign on here an indication that the Democrats are not yet united around a deep agenda?
Well, I think Democrats are quite united around the need for a new direction. And look, we'd love to have the same outcome that Newt Gingrich had in 1994, and we're hoping for that. And we think that the plan is the best new Congress that 1995 can buy. But as Rahm said, we thought we should base our book on campaign promises that we actually intended to keep, which the Contract of America was not. The Contract of America was a poll-tested group of slogans that, by and large, that Republican Congress has failed to keep over the last decade, and you know, the country's paying a price for it now.
Rahm Emanuel, we're going to turn to the points in your five-point plan here in just a second. But let me ask you, what's the fundamental challenge you see the Democratic Party facing? Not the country for a minute. You've spoken to that. But the Democrats, you know, by some measures, you'd think, whoa, they ought to just be sweeping in, not a jump ball on this state. Of course, there's other ways of interpreting that, the current situation of the country. But many Democrats see it that way. And yet there's this open question. How do you see the Democrats' fundamental challenge looking forward from 2006?
Well, I mean, you do say you don't want me to address it. I think the fundamental challenge for the party is also the fundamental challenge for the country. Hmm. So I don't kind of separate
them. Okay.
Because I mean, there are people have some questions about our party. They have a lot of questions also about the Republican Party, and there's some doubts about both parties that exist. But that said, what we, as we say in the book, people don't hire Democrats to whine about problems, but they hire Democrats to solve problems. If you look at the successful period of time when we balanced the budget, reformed welfare, people's attitudes about government changed dramatically. They saw the government as a voice and a force, an affirmative force for change and in the right direction. And we need to give that same sense of reform to government so people again believe that government can be a force for good rather than a negative force. And post-Katrina, post-Iraq, and we're not, oh, no, it's hard to say post-Iraq because we're in the middle of it, people's sense of the capacity of government is really deteriorated. And especially, I mean, this administration has run down the notion and done it successfully through the failures of their policies and their execution of those policies, the notion that government can be a force for good.
Is that good for Democrats or bad, then, if people don't believe in it?
It is problematic, but they still believe that in fighting terrorism, dealing with health care, dealing with national challenges, be that on the economy or energy policy, et cetera, the government basically a sense of our community is the best vehicle to nationally meet these challenges. Mm. We've done it before, and Democrats then will step forward, and that's why Bruce and I wrote this book. We have a set of ideas, and I think it's important to be, not only as a party in opposition, you have a job to do two things, oppose and propose. And we need to do both, and I think our idea of in the book called The Plan is to lay out what we propose to do to meet the challenges, and I think if we do that, the political benefits will accrue. I think the problem for the last 6 years is people have looked at each problem and figured out how to get the political benefit without how to try to solve the policy problem, and that has hindered the country in a dramatic way.
No more divisive, smash mouth, take no prisoners politics, say Rahm Emanuel.
Let's not go too far here, Tom.
You're ready to rumble?
You're obviously taking the medication a little far here.
Let's not do that. Words from your book. We're going to turn to that five-point plan in 1 second. Let me get just a couple of calls in here. Harry's calling from Sumter, South Carolina. Hi, Harry. What do you hear? What do you think?
Well, it appears to me that President Bush has decided that his people can win if he runs against Osama bin Laden. And I'm hoping that the Democrats will stay on message and not take the bait this time, which they normally do.
How do you avoid taking the bait?
Well, letting him set the agenda and making the election about terrorism. There's tremendous money, backing the Republicans from so-called think tanks that are really, advocacy groups to campaign contributions that give them a great deal of money to get their message across. And if the Democrats let them pick the fight, then I'm afraid that they'll lose again. There's so many issues that are other issues that are strongly in the Democratic Party's corner.
Yeah, Harry, we hear it. Let us pick it up. Bruce Reed, you and Rahm Emanuel write in The Plan that this whole issue of framing is the wrong thing to focus on. But Harry calls from Sumter and says, be careful you don't get framed into the president's perspective on the war on terror right now in the run-up to the midterm elections. What about that big push we've seen in the last couple of weeks? Is it bringing the GOP back to prominence? Is it hurting you guys?
I don't think it's going to work this time. Harry's absolutely right that we shouldn't let President Bush win the debate on terror. I don't think he is winning that. You know, the other night he gave an address from the Oval Office where he promised yet again that that sooner or later he's going to find bin Laden. Just a day after, the Washington Post reported that the CIA itself hadn't had a credible lead on finding bin Laden in 2 years, and that the trail was stone cold. So we're happy to have a debate about terrorism, but it ought to be how we're going to succeed in the war on terror. And in the plan, we lay out a number of ideas of how to get the country to, which under the Bush administration has kind of taken its eye off the ball in the war on terror, to get back to doing the kinds of things that will actually win.
We better pull the veil off this plan that you and Rahm Emanuel keep talking about so our listeners have some sense of it. Rahm, begin to take us in here. You've got a 5-point plan, big one, you say, for long term, not just for winning elections, but for really governing, for meeting new challenges. What does it look like?
Well, I do want to say on one thing, Tom,
sure,
if I can.
Sure.
Democrats are going to talk and are going to continue to talk about the two pillars of security, national and economic security. And you got to do both. And on the war on terror specifically, one, double up, not disband the group that's supposed to find Osama bin Laden, which happened under President Bush, but commit our forces in Afghanistan to finding him and bring him to justice. Two, bring a new direction to our war in Iraq, not the way that, as you've seen by two generals over the weekend. One said we don't have enough troops. The other one said, Secretary Rumsfeld said, don't plan for the occupation. Three,
a new direction as in out the door or stay and fight?
No, there's to how to win, because basically they have a course of not doing either. Third, up or down vote on the 9/11 Commission recommendations, which has not happened to date. And fourth, you cannot have a war on strategy if you do not have an energy policy of independence and a strategy for energy independence. That is a successful, comprehensive war on terror and a strategy. Now, to the other point, let's go down a couple points that we talk about. And I want to use these as examples to illustrate as we deal with what I call the economic or the 5 points as we lay out.
Okay. A new social contract, you say, with more responsibility in it. Like what?
Well, we talk about universal civilian service, that somewhere between the ages of 18 and 25, every individual would give 3 months of service to their country in civil defense training. So if you have a natural catastrophe or, obviously, God forbid, a terrorist act, people know what to do to help evacuate people. They know what to do to handle the challenges. We did when
3 months sounds kind of small when we've got troops spending years in Iraq. Now, three months is not much of a tap on the shoulder.
Tom,
yep.
Bruce and I will not argue whether it's 3 months or 4 months, but the notion that we have some form of national service like the Peace Corps and AmeriCorps.
For everybody.
Yeah, 18 to 25, everybody, and it would bring this country together with a common experience of what, again, means to be an American. Two, universal children's health care, so that every child has health care in this country. We've done it in Illinois. Take that program, and in 2007, the program Bruce and I worked on for President Clinton, which was health care for children of working parents who have no health care, is now take that to every child, regardless of precondition or income, and those who make more pay higher premium and more per child.
How do you pay for that?
With the fraud and waste and overpaying that exists in the prescription drug bill. We are subsidizing the HMO industry by $130 billion over and above what we pay in Medicare, and the pharmaceutical company by $139 billion in additional profits under the prescription drug bill. By competition in the prescription drug purchase and in the HMO area, you could pay for children's health care.
You want universal college access. What do you mean by that? College becomes like high school? Everybody goes?
Well, in the sense of this, that today we have an economy where you earn what you learn. And yet we've done nothing with that new recognition that a college education is the key to your economic success and key to our success, that we have the best trained and educated workforce. Yet we've never done anything to update the policies and the investment strategy on the federal level. We have 5 separate programs on the tax code, Hope Scholarship, Lifetime Learning, etc., all to help people go to college. Create one, roll them all up into one simplified $3,000 deduction for going to college, graduate school, or any point in your life that you go back to school to bone up on your skills. Take the subsidies we give big banks for the student loan program, about $15 billion a year, and turn it into a tuition grant program, just like the land-grant college under the Lincoln era.
So a lot more kids going to college.
The number one reason people quit school, and we have now one of the lowest graduation rates of any industrialized country, cost. The average graduate of college, four-year school today, comes out with a debt of $22,000 a year. Cost is making college education prohibitive.
So learn to earn. You also say universal retirement savings, 401ks for all. Is that instead of Social Security, in addition to what?
In addition, you have the retirement security is based on three pillars: Social Security, personal savings, and employer-based retirement. If the war is happening today, and I represent about 20,000 United Airlines employees in my district, those United Airlines employees who saw their defined benefit plan shredded up, you ask them if they like Social Security. They like the security that comes with Social Security. Now, so what you have to do to have people prepare for this new world is everybody has to become a saver. So automatic enrollment in a 401k, direct deposit of your tax refunds, if you choose, into your savings account. You do those steps, savings and the dollar amounts dramatically increase, and people become savers. We have a company in Illinois, R.R. Donnelly, the big publisher. They went to an automatic enrollment of into 401k plan. They went from 62% participation in their savings up to 93% of their employees, and mainly picked up a lot of secretarial pool, et cetera, workers who wouldn't save otherwise. And then you have a secure, you have people planning for their retirement, saving for their retirement. And once that happens, you'll have what I call the political capital to then tackle the challenge of Social Security. But as long as the private sector is shredding the defined benefit plan, people are going to hold on to their Social Security and say, I don't want a single change or any alteration. Help people save.
Bruce Reed, you talk about a new ethic of responsibility in Washington, fiscal discipline and corporate welfare. Throw the hacks out, big language. Why should the country trust Democrats to do that now?
They should trust us to do it now because we did it before. Look, as if we're going to have the kind of big ideas that Rahm just talked about, we need to cut and invest in order to pay for them. The only way we're going to do that is if we bring back the kind of fiscal responsibility that that the Clinton administration brought to Washington in the 90s. I think all across the country, there are a lot of independents and disgruntled Republicans who thought that when President Bush promised a responsibility era, that that's what they were going to get. But instead, we've seen record deficits. And so in the book, we lay out a number of ways to get the country back on track. First and foremost, we embrace an idea for a binding corporate welfare commission that would literally end corporate welfare as we know it.
Mark is calling from Washington. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Listen, I'd like to make a couple of suggestions. I think one thing that would help a lot is if the Democrats in presenting their positions would be a little less glib and a little more succinct in their points. For instance, I heard Mr. Emanuel going on a litany of accomplishments, which were quite legitimate under the Clinton administration. But I think it would be far simpler to state, for instance, that when Clinton left and Bush came in, the country was never stronger or richer. That says it all. The next thing is, unlike Nancy Pelosi, where she talks about this culture of corruption, which I'm sorry to say most people associate with most politicians, they should talk about the culture of incompetence. You know, there's so much out there to work with. Think about it a little bit. Go to some coaches who might tell you how to be more succinct and more pointed in your positions. Look, the Republicans have come out and publicly stated that they're going to spend a fortune on trying to slime Democratic candidates. These people are vicious. Now, I'm not saying we should be the same way, but we need to be tough and we need to be intelligent.
Let us pick it up. Mark, Rahm Emanuel, how about it? Mark wants it on a bumper sticker. We were never better off. Now we're bad off.
Well, some people have, you know, we've had people call in. I think Newt Gingrich's was, have you had enough? That was his motto. Some are talking about vote Democrat for a change, all capturing the same kind of point. I think, look, I don't disagree about the importance of getting your agenda down as down to a simple bumper sticker or a basic concept. And that's why I always say that we're running as New Direction Democrats, because the country, when you have 68% of the country thinking the country's heading off in the wrong direction, you want to be the other direction. And we, by de facto of being the party out of power, are that. I do think that, as we argue in And this is not a show that we're just trying to figure out what's the best bumper sticker.
Mm-hmm.
Ideas matter in politics. That's one thing President Clinton showed us. It's one thing that also having worked for Mayor Daley in Chicago, ideas matter. This was not intended to only talk about bumper stickers, and I agree with Mark's basic general thrust of what he says. But it's also to say the policies matter and what you do if you're lucky enough not just to win elections for the sake of winning, but to also win for America in the sense of the policies you put in place that I think have to turn this country around and get the country heading in the right direction again. And so I don't disagree with wanting to boil it down to a simple thing and being as tough. That's what I'm doing as the chair of the DCCC, as we did last night in Arizona and other places. But don't lose sight that actual things, the reason Social Security is so powerful as an issue is because it's such a successful program. The reason Medicare is so powerful as a political issue is because it's such a successful program in dealing with the health care crisis we had when one out of three seniors lived in poverty in the 60s prior to it. That's why policy and ideas matter in politics.
Let me get a call from Savannah, Georgia. Natalie is on the air. Hi, Natalie.
Hi. You know, I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I am finding myself extremely disappointed in the consistent co-opting of Republican terms that misrepresent Democratic positions.
What do you mean? Mm-hmm.
Well, for example, in Savannah right now, we have a very close election between John Barrow and Max Burns.
Mm.
And recently, John Barrow ran a ad on television that co-opted the term cut and run in Iraq.
So you've got a Democrat talking about cut and run.
And, you know, I'm really disgusted with that. I think that cut and run phrase misrepresents how most Democrats feel. I think that now that we're there, most Democrats feel that we need to work smart to get out and not just leave with Iraq in such a mess. And for him to put that on his commercial in that way sort of validates it as if it is true.
As if the other party maybe sort of owns the worldview business here. Natalie, let us pick that up. Bruce Reed, how about it? The Republicans have been in power for quite a while now. Is it a problem for Democrats to get away from Republican language, Republican worldview here?
Well, I think it's important that we try to rise above bumper sticker politics for that very reason. Our advantage, our strength, is that we are trying to propose answers that will actually work. And over the last 6 years, American politics has taken on a bad case of the Karl Rove flu, which is a crippling disease that destroys any part of the brain not dedicated to partisan political manipulation.
What exactly are you proposing that will actually work in Iraq? What exactly?
Well, let me get to that in a moment. And just finish the point, which is that, you know, it's important for Democrats to realize that the best politics for us is to actually put forward answers that solve the country's problems, that the Republican strategy has been to divide the country, to make the political debate as shallow as possible because they think that works for them.
We've got that. So pick up the most difficult one of all, then. What will actually work in Iraq? What is it that the Democrats are proposing there?
Go ahead, Ron.
Well, here, Tom, let's first of all, since you want to talk about, here's what Republicans are saying. We've got 3.5 years, 2,600-plus American lives lost, $310 billion we spent, and we've lost 19,000 people are permanently wounded. Barely the Anbar province nor the Green Zone are fully secure. But if we do more of the same, hopefully something else will happen.
Mm.
That is their strategy, and never question a single thing about that policy.
So what's yours?
I happen to believe that Senator Biden's laid out a very sophisticated strategy for the future of Iraq, that there's a Kurdish north, a Sunni middle, and a Shiite south.
One country three?
It'd be one country, three provinces with a federated area. That is how the country is moving. It would also give us a strategy to have a victory there. Right now, we have sent in too few troops without a plan for success, without the equipment to have success, and without a plan for the occupation. In fact, over the weekend, we learned from the general that Secretary Rumsfeld in the preparation for the war specifically said there will be no planning for the occupation. And the three major decisions, the size of the troop level, the debathification, and planning for an occupation all have shown a rotten strategy, and we haven't done anything different. And all we're being told is if you do more of the same, something else may happen for us, luckily. And I've said, and I think Senator Biden's laid out, and other Democrats have laid out, at least ideas that give you a chance for success. Following the present course, which is the Republican course, is not a plan for success. It's just a plan for more of the same in Iraq.
Your Democrats plan calls for 100,000 more troops in the U.S. Army. Would you send them to Iraq?
Well, that is up to both the Secretary of Defense and the Commander-in-Chief. You have one at a time. But wait, first of all, and you're not going to build them overnight here, but it's clear that this war on terror requires a bigger armed forces, given our obligations both in Afghanistan, Iraq, and then throughout the Far East, where there's a growing, and in the Mideast, where there's a growing Muslim unrest and terrorist planning. Our armed forces have been stretched thin to the breaking point, as reported by the Pentagon. Now, what is the plan to deal with a military's both reserve, guard, and active duty that is at the breaking point? We have an idea, add 100,000 more troops, because the Army itself, that unit, has been degraded the worst under the Iraq stress, the war, the stress from the Iraq war.
More troops, more allies, and better intelligence, say Rahm Emanuel and Bruce Reed in their plan. Callers, what do you think? Brian's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing? Mr. Reed, Mr. Emanuel, great honor to talk to you.
It's an honor to hear from you, Brian.
I'm a high school educator. I'm a principal. And I believe every student in this country should have the option to go to some sort of secondary learning academy if they so choose, and they have the ability to do so. So I agree with you there. But what I'm calling about is I'm wondering, has any attention been paid to any Democrats who may jump to the Republican side simply because they do support the war, not so much any of the candidates running to take over the House or the Senate, but just to show support for the war and the president? Has any attention been paid to that?
Rahm Emanuel.
Brian, if I think I understand your question, is have we focused on kind of Democratic-leaning voters who may break from being voting Democrat but vote supporting Republicans because of the war or the war on terror or Iraq? Is that the do I have the question correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, we have on both a national level and then across the districts we're competing. But we've also focused on Republican voters who are, and independent voters, who are very dispirited by the president's war in Iraq and his the fiscal mess that they've run the country through. And so we have focused on, if you wanted to break the electorate up into segments, Democrats who may move away from the Democratic Party for one reason or another, and Republicans and independents who have historically voted Republican at the congressional level but now are ready to vote Democrat for a series of reasons, Iraq, or it was what I like to call this endless occupation and this wageless recovery. So we focused on numerous different subgroups of voters.
Brian, let me ask you, your pals there in North Carolina, in your circle, are they leaning Democrat or leaning Republican? How are they voting?
I have to say 90% of them who are Democrat are leaning Republican simply because they support the war. I support our troops, just like any American would. I don't support the war. But they support the war, they support the president, and why we're there. And for that simple reason, they're ready to jump ship and go Republican.
Rahm Emanuel, what do you say to that? To hear Brian's got 90% of his Democrat friends ready to vote Republican to support the president on the war.
Well, one of the interesting issues that Brian just talked about is the support of the troops. You know, it was a very powerful vote in 2003. We lost it, 213 to 213, about a combat bonus pay for reserve and guardists, and the Republicans had defeated what could have been a big support for our troops, and we've done that on health care, et cetera. But there are two competitive races in North Carolina that neither party knows who's going to be who's going to win. Both are defending Republicans with Democratic challengers. One is Heath Shuler, the former football player in the Asheville area. Another one is Larry Kissel, a school teacher, former worker in the apparel industry and textile industry that has literally left the state against Robin Hayes. And so the Republicans are defending two seats, and what should be Republican safe seats are both up for grabs. And one of the reasons they're doing well is they're getting crossover appeal from Republicans and independents, as well as solid Democrats who want to support Democratic candidates. So in North Carolina, the Republicans are playing defense, and Democrats are on offense.
Let me take a call from Baltimore. Stacy's on the line. Hi, Stacy. You're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing today?
We're all right. What do you think, Stacey?
Hey, I was just wondering, I'm a Republican myself, and I agree with President Bush on a lot of things. And, I mean, there's just some things he's done that, you know, it's unforgivable that he's done. And I don't understand some of the reasons. But my question is, what are the Democrats planning to do for the border, you know, control the borders?
And immigration and illegal immigration. Stacey, thanks for your call. Bruce Reed, how about it? What's the Democrat proposal? What's yours?
Well, the first thing we ought to do is to beef up our efforts to enforce the laws that are already on the books. The Bush administration has tried to make a big issue out of immigration 6 years into the game. When we took office in the 90s, we inherited a similar problem of a lot of illegal immigration. And through a strong law enforcement strategy, we were able to put that problem to rest.
And yet the numbers of illegal immigrants grew steadily through the 90s.
Number of immigrants, of illegal immigrants crossing the border dropped during our time. But look, there's no question that we need to address this problem from both ends. We need a very tall fence, as columnist Tom Friedman likes to say, and a big gate. We're a nation of immigrants, but we should be welcoming more legal immigration. But the Bush administration has neglected some of the basics. They've created this enormous Department of Homeland Security, 180,000 employees, folded every single bureaucracy in Washington into it, and as a result, done a poor job of executing the most basic functions of government, from border control to responding to disasters to gathering intelligence.
We've got a couple of points we haven't come to here, and our time grows short. I just want to be sure they're on the table. A hybrid economy, you say you want to push for, cut America's gasoline use in half over the next decade, tax reform for the middle class. Rahm Emanuel, let me put just a basic question to you, though. Republicans have been pretty strong, and the proof is in the pudding in the polls, in arguing from their kind of basic principles to the country that they ought to govern. Do you think the Democrats' basic principles are as powerful and appealing with the American electorate, or have we seen in the last decade that they're simply not?
Well, I think, I do believe that Democratic principles of what we like to call a cut and invest strategy, making cuts in the federal budget, and investment strategy on both, as you said, hybrid energy or a hybrid economy, new technologies that would transform our economy like the Internet did, is the right strategy. They've tried to and have succeeded at certain points in using taxes as a rubric of the economic argument, but have across the board on the economy, taxes, budget, and every area, not just traditional Democratic areas like education, healthcare, etc. Democrats are now besting the Republicans of which party you trust to handle those issues. So as we've maintained and grown our strength in areas like the environment, education, healthcare, we've now are bettering the Republicans in the areas of budget, stewardship of the economy, and taxes. And why is that? Because the Republican mess and Democrats offering ideas, like we do in this book, of how to have a fair and simple tax code, how to have an energy policy that's part of both your national security policy as well as strengthening America's energy independence here at home is the right strategy. And I think that, I didn't take my hat off at certain points to how the Republicans over the last 6 years have tried to twist certain issues. But Democrats have a successful electoral strategy, and you're going to see it in 06 in the sense of showing people how we would present our arguments as well as how we would be given the helm, be stewards of this country's capacity to build for the future.
Just a couple of seconds here. What's your big target, November or 08? If you want to change the country, when do you do it?
Election by election.
Election by election, and a big one standing right in front of you. I want to thank you both for being with us today. Rahm Emanuel, chair of the Democrats' Congressional Campaign Committee, 5th District Congressman from Illinois. Rahm Emanuel, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
And Bruce Reed, president of the Democratic Leadership Council, editor-in-chief of Blueprint at the DLC, the monthly journal there, political columnist for Slate. Bruce Reed, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
The book is The Plan, Big Ideas for America. Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.